This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we'll talk about the case of Breonna Waters, a 32-year-old mother and violin teacher who was recently sentenced to 6 years in prison and ordered to pay $6 million in restitution. Her crime? The government claims she acted as a lookout for an arson. The defense says she was 60 miles away at the time of the crime. We'll hear about a victory in the case of the so-called Bangor Six.
These are six people in Bangor, Maine, who sat in on their Republican Senator Collins' office protesting the war, tried for their crime of trespass, and they beat the charge.
We'll also bring you the voices of tourists, activists, and James Yee, former U.S. Army chaplain, who visited a life-size Guantanamo cell replica on the National Mall. It was sponsored by Amnesty International. Stay with us.
Welcome to Law and Disorder. This is Michael Ratner, president of the Center for Constitutional Rights.
I'm Michael Smith, New York City attorney and author.
I'm Heidi Boghossian, executive director of the National Lawyers Guild.
I'm Dahlia Hashad, director of the USA program at Amnesty International.
Here on Law and Disorder, we four lawyers and activists will strive to be your eyes and ears, your early warning system, your educators, counselors, and advocates. Here, we'll talk about the laws, practices, and procedures that we believe are strangling democracy. We'll be in the courts, in the books, on the streets, and here on the radio with you. We hope that we'll be lawyers you will like.
The great civil liberties attorney Bill Kunstler saw it coming. The police state is emerging, he warned. It's coming piece by piece, before and especially after September 11th.
We start today's updates with a rather stunning development coming out of Rhode Island. A Rhode Island school district has launched a pilot program to monitor students' movements by putting RFID chips into their school bags. The Middletown School District has partnered with MAP Information Technology to implant 80 school bags with these chips. They're read by an external device that is held in two school buses. Parents and school officials can then log on to a computer and monitor whereabouts of the students so they can see if they've gotten onto the school bus, if they've left. The ACLU in Rhode Island has not surprisingly criticized this program, but the school district says it doesn't think it's a problem, doesn't think it's going to be open to abuse, i.e. unauthorized individuals somehow having access to the scanners to track where the kids are. What's very interesting, though, is that the program is being given to the school district for free. And because of that, it doesn't need approval by the Rhode Island Ethics Commission. The government has just charged Dr. Sami Alarian with criminal contempt in a 2-count indictment for refusing to testify before grand juries. For years, Dr. Sami Alarian, who was acquitted by a trial of his own peers, has been the object of the government's continued persecution. He's been on hunger strikes for standing up for his moral convictions that he signed a plea agreement in which the government said he would never have to appear before a grand jury. Yet on 3 subsequent occasions, they served him with subpoenas to do that very thing, appear before a grand jury, trying to get information out of him about possible terrorist activities of other groups. Now, most recently, he's been served with now a criminal contempt charge for refusing to appear before the last 2 grand jury requests. He has trial set for August 16th. The judge says she thinks it's going to be a simple matter, one day in court. His defense attorney, Jonathan Turley, says, no, it's going to be a lot more complicated. So the struggle for Dr. Alarian's freedom, because he remains in prison during this time, continues, really is a political case in which the government is just going after this innocent man in any way that it can. Here on Law and Disorder, we've discussed how, since December 2005, environmental activists in the United States have been targeted and handed extremely harsh prison sentences. It's called the Green Scare. And a couple of years ago, the National Lawyers Guild established a hotline, 1-888-NLG-ECOL, for activists who have been targeted by the FBI for environmental activism. We bring this up in context of the case involving Breonna Waters. Breonna was accused of acting as a lookout and conspiring to set fire to the University of Washington's Center for Urban Horticulture in 2001. This, despite evidence presented by the defense that she was 60 miles away at the time of the arson. Others claimed responsibility for the fire, but Miss Waters, a 32-year-old mother and violin teacher, could have faced a mandatory minimum of 35 years in prison. We bring this to you again because Breonna Waters was recently sentenced to 6 years in federal prison and also ordered to pay $6 million in restitution. Here to talk about her case and the politics especially of this case is California civil rights attorney Ben Rosenfeld. Let's have a listen. Welcome, Ben, to Law and Disorder.
Good morning, Heidi.
Ben, who is Breonna Waters?
Breonna Waters is one of the targets of the FBI and federal government's Green Scare, or what they call Operation Backfire. She's an environmental activist and student, and a former student at the time she was alleged to have committed the arsons that they accuse her of committing. She steadfastly maintains her innocence, and an award-winning filmmaker as well.
What's Operation Green Scare?
Operation Green Scare is the name given to the FBI's witch hunt against what they sort of sloppily lumped together as radical environmentalists, ELF or ALF members, sometimes just anarchists. And they've been targeting these people since 9/11 in this kind of stepped-up so-called domestic terrorism witch hunt. And the reason people call it the Green Scare is because it harkens back to the darkest days of the Red Scare, when we went after people for one ideology, and now people are being targeted for another.
What is the exact charge? Breonna was convicted.
Yes.
And she was convicted of being a lookout.
She was convicted of conspiracy to commit arson, and the conduct that they attributed to her was crouching in the bushes with the radio as a lookout while fellow conspirators set fire to a building at the University of Washington in May of 2001. The evidence, I should say, all points away from her, and the case was absolutely rife with government and prosecutorial misconduct, and the evidence in no way added up or pointed to her culpability. But the trial was one of the most rigged trials and worrisome spectacles I've ever seen in a courtroom.
Now, weren't there receipts showing that she, in fact, was at least 60 miles away at the time the arson was committed?
Yeah, the defense was delighted, or so they thought, when they dug up a receipt showing that she was in Olympia, Washington, at the time the two informants, that is, participants turned state's evidence who testified against her in exchange for leniency, said that she was at a meeting prior to the commission of the arson in Seattle.
I think what you just mentioned in terms of the turning state evidence is a hallmark of a lot of these prosecutions. The government really intimidates individuals, often young activists who have committed maybe property crimes, but nothing life-threatening, and offers to strike plea agreements with them if they'll give names of others who may have been involved. And what we've seen is a lot of people giving names of individuals who actually weren't involved.
Well, sure, because what you're describing is a very traditional by-the-numbers sort of investigation and prosecution. But what's different here is they're wielding this huge cudgel over people's heads in the form of a so-called destructive device enhancement charge, which carries a mandatory minimum of 30 years. And so they accuse the people they've gone after in these cases of using a destructive device within the meaning of the statute, but the statute talks about grenades and missiles and bombs and sort of weapons of mass destruction and at least things that go boom. But in this case, the devices used were just delayed incendiary devices designed to give the arsonist time to get away, but they didn't explode. They simply burned slowly, and yet somehow through some tortured logic and I should say the collusion of the courts in these cases, they've managed to pervert these devices into so-called destructive devices.
You know, I wasn't that familiar with this whole issue for a while, and I had to teach somewhere in the East the other day, and I talked to a bunch of people from the West Coast who've been going through some of these cases, and I was just appalled. And it's exactly what you said. It's that they say 30 years or else, the enhancement charge, and then they cave in people because of that. And it's a way of really destroying a movement, an environmental movement. And it's something that on the East Coast, where we're broadcasting from, is not well known at all. But when I talk to these activists, lawyers and others who spent their summers out there, it was really a shocking story as to what the government is doing now.
Well, the phenomenon of extracting false confessions out of people who are facing potential death sentences is, of course, well documented. And I would submit that probably a very similar psychology is at work in these cases when you're facing what really begins at a 30-year sentence, because added to that, of course, are the more standard sentences for arson and conspiracy. And so you're looking at really at life sentences. And I think that it probably has the same psychological toll and works to cause false accusations. People will say anything to get out of that.
Ben, what has your involvement been in this case and any others like it?
Well, I'm a member of the Civil Liberties Defense Center, which is a civil rights organization based in Eugene, Oregon, and the CLDC has provided legal resources and support to the activist community broadly and to some of the individual defendants and their attorneys who've been targeted in these cases.
We know you're on your way to court and appreciate your joining us. Just in the last couple of minutes, how many years is Brianna facing? Is there an appeal being brought?
Sure. Brianna, when she is sentenced on May 30th, if that day holds, is facing up to 20 years in prison, because the jury convicted Brianna Waters of arson, but they hung on the conspiracy counts and the destructive device count. She faces up to 20 years for her conviction of arson. It's very interesting to observe that in the midst of the jury deliberations, other fires were set north of Seattle, within tens of miles of where the fire she was accused of participating in was set. And there's no doubt that whoever set those fires meant that they'd be connected back to this trial. And in fact, the government did everything it could to make those connections and engaged in what I think was probably tantamount to jury tampering. And indeed, the headline caught fire literally from coast to coast, and the federal government was there to make the connections to the Brianna Waters case. And so it's kind of remarkable, even in the midst of that, the jury was able to hang on these other charges. But we think that the whole process was severely polluted, and yes, there will be an appeal.
I understand that she has a child. Normally, people would be given, like Lynn Stewart, given bail pending an appeal, and instead they just took her and put her in jail. I thought that was in line with the cruelty of the whole prosecution.
Well, I think it definitely shows the cruelty of it, and they didn't seek jail time even for the informants who are confessed arsonists in these cases, and I should point out, who have confessed to committing more than just the one. And in this case, they literally ripped her from her 3-year-old daughter, who was still breastfeeding at the time, and it is a tragedy within a tragedy, and incredibly painful to have observed. And there was a point later where traumatized jail guards literally had to rip this child's hands from her mother's hair while she was screaming at the end of a visit. And I've seen the two of them together, and they're a beautiful pair, and she's really an amazing child. And Brianna is an incredibly loving, smart, and devoted mother. It's a human rights tragedy as well as a miscarriage of justice.
Ben, it's great to hear from you again, and we're glad that you're a spokesperson on behalf of this and other cases. We look forward to having you on again to hear, hopefully, some positive news.
Well, thank you. Thanks for your attention to it.
Thanks, Ben.
Recently, jurors in the case of the so-called Bangor Six brought back a decisive court victory of not guilty. The six anti-war protesters were arrested in March of last year after refusing to leave the federal building where their senator, Republican Susan Collins, has her office. The six activists were among 12 that say they were protesting Bush's proposal to increase troops in Iraq to support a military strategy known as the Surge. And they urged Collins to vote against continued funding for the war. Collins did not vote against funding for the war and did not meet with the activists. Six of them were later arrested. During the trial, the jury was instructed to decide if the defendants honestly believed that they were not guilty in making a conscious choice to break Maine law because they thought international law was being violated. The jurors decided unanimously that the protesters did believe that they had the so-called license and privilege to act as they did in rendering the not guilty verdict. Today we talk with Bar Harbor attorney Lynn Williams, also with Maine Lawyers for Democracy, and a member of the National Lawyers Guild. Welcome, Lynn, to Law and Disorder.
Thank you.
And congratulations on your recent victory in the case of the so-called Bangor Six. Can you give our listeners a brief overview of the case?
Yes, of course. Over a year ago, last March, 12 peace activists from Maine, as part of the National Occupation Project, went to Senator Susan Collins' office in Bangor, Maine, in order to present her with a letter urging her to vote against continuing funding for the war in Iraq. At the federal building where Senator Collins' office is located, only six activists were permitted up to her office, and the rest were retained in the lobby and told that when the ones upstairs came down, then they could go up, but that there were only allowed to be six people in the office at one time. As the day wore on, staff was cordial and nonviolent and peaceful, but in fact the staff did not get Senator Collins on the phone, so there was no communication as the activists had wanted. At 5 o'clock, when at least Senator Collins' office was going to close, those sitting in her office, as well as those in the lobby, were asked to leave the building. They refused the order to leave, and they were subsequently arrested and charged with criminal trespass.
Lynn, I'm confused. Six went up, and Collins wasn't even in the office?
That's correct.
They were going to get her on the telephone.
Well, that's what they would have wanted. They wanted to talk to her on the telephone, and this is neither the first series of arrests nor the first time that they've done this.
They've let protesters go up.
Oh,
they've
yes.
sat there.
Yes, yes. Since the beginning of the war, they've been doing this. They have met with our Congressman Michael Mishu, not only after hours, but on weekends when he's home. And so they're, you know, home in the district. And so they frequently visit the offices. Typically, the elected official is not there, although Congressman Mishu is much more accessible.
Has this senator had other people arrested prior to the six?
Oh, yeah. I think this was the second set of arrests in her office and the federal building. And there have been two sets of arrests in Senator Olympia Snowe's office and her office building. And there was one set of arrests at Democratic Congressman Tom Allen's office.
What were the charges? They were on federal property.
No, and not federal charges. They were state charges.
Okay.
And so it was the state, and therein sort of lies the crux of the defense. It was a state charge of criminal trespass.
Well, it seems to me that they weren't wanted there. They continued being there. How did attorney Lynn Williams defend and win in such an obviously guilty situation? What could you do?
Well, it was myself and actually my co-counsel, Phil Warden, and we represented six of those 12 that were arrested prior to the time of trial pled no contest.
And let's explain for those who haven't been arrested before.
A guilty plea is an admission of guilt, and then there's a sentence. A no-contest plea is not an admission of guilt, but it's typically construed by a court as the same as a guilty plea when it comes to sentence. This is frequently done in cases in criminal cases, which might evolve into civil litigation, you know, personal injury, that sort of thing. So there's no guilty plea on the record that could then be entered in a subsequent civil suit. In this case, the clients felt very strongly that they were not guilty of anything, and so the
because they had a right to be there and be heard.
Because they had a right to be there. So those six took their pleas, no contest pleas, and received fines. The other six decided to go to trial. Three represented themselves, and they were called pro se. They did not have attorneys. And Phil Warden represented one defendant, and I represented two. We agreed to let the court join the cases so they would all go to trial together. The key to our defense was in the language of the statute of criminal defense. And people who are not in Maine have to realize that each state has its own criminal code. So our words in our statute are not necessarily the same as those in New York, for example. But our criminal trespass, the elements of the crime are that the individual, and here's the key part, knowing that he was not licensed or privileged to be there, refused to leave a certain location after being given a lawful order to leave. So although there are certain arguments about who can give a lawful order, we didn't focus on that. What we focused on was a state of mind defense, that the defendants essentially thought they had a right to be there, even if that perception was wrong.
Got it.
What was their perception that they had a right to be there based on?
That was based on, and that was exactly how we got evidence about international law and the Nuremberg tribunals into the record.
Do tell.
So what? Tell us how you did this.
What's going on? What made you think that you could stay there? Well, in my readings of the transcripts from the Nuremberg trials, I was really given the impression that not only did I have a right to be there, I had a responsibility to be there. The judge was very clear with us. We could not rely on an international law defense. And we didn't dispute that. You know, she ruled on that, and that was that. She also was clear to us that she would give an instruction to the jury that international law is no defense to a state crime of criminal trespass.
But can I stop you there?
Yes.
I thought international law, in terms of the treaties that the United States has signed on to, thus becomes a part of U.S. law.
Under the Sixth Amendment, it becomes the law of the land, you know, the treaties.
Right.
Sixth Amendment to the Constitution specifies that. It becomes problematical when you're dealing with a state law.
Mm.
And I have to say, I explained to my clients what I perceived as the distinction between saying, under the Nuremberg trials and under the treaties, I can do this legally, even though it is a state criminal offense. And my perception really is there's a difference between what happened in Nazi Germany, where by not violating a state law to kill and enslave Jews, by not violating a state law or a country law, you thereby violated international human rights law, in essence. By not going to Senator Collins' office, they were not violating any international law. They truly believed they had a right to be there. They had to show the court that that was a true and sincere belief. They could not make the argument that I had to commit criminal trespass. We were not allowed to present the defense where the defendant would argue, even though I knew I was breaking state law, international law required me to do this.
Your defense was that they honestly believed that under international law they weren't breaking the law.
Exactly.
Got it. Was it a jury trial or a bench trial?
Oh, it was a jury trial.
How long did your case go on, and how long was the jury out?
Well, the first day we did the jury selection, we got favorable rulings on that. I submitted a motion to use a written juror questionnaire, somewhat longer than we ended up with, but the judge was interested in and agreed to submit three written questions to the jury pool. One was, do you know what civil disobedience is? The second was, have you ever been inconvenienced by a protest, strike, sit-in, or like activity? And the third was, do you think the restrictions on protest activities should be strengthened? Immediately from the start, anyone who answered yes to question two or three was eliminated. And we thought we'd have to have sidebar questioning, further questioning of those individuals, and he just eliminated them. He also asked orally if any person is currently in the military or had been in the military or had had any family member currently or in the past in the military. That was about 70% of the jury pool.
Right.
They were not, of course, automatically eliminated, but he asked a follow-up question to those folks. Would this military activity by you and or your family member impede your ability to be fair and unbiased in this case?
That's wonderful,
yes,
Lynn.
It was incredible. The judge, that question eliminated about another seven people. Then we had probably about 40 left, and I had done background research on the internet and identified some really bad ones for our side had already been eliminated, which was great. And so I had sort of ranked the really great ones that I wanted to see if we could keep in. And we essentially did.
Lynn, let's talk about the big picture and what this means for the larger efforts around the country. This is a positive outcome for those of us who believe in the right to dissent, the right to exercise our ability to engage in civil disobedience, to make a statement. This is one of those positive decisions. Do you think we're seeing a trend in more decisions like this?
I think there are a number of factors. I think possibly we had a better jury pool than we may have had when we did a similar trial 3 years ago. And so we started maybe with people who might have been the same people, you know, theoretically, except I think society as a whole is more against the war, much more openly against the war than they were even 3 years ago.
Right.
I think that's part of it. Part of it, I think the jury selection part was key also. And I have to say afterwards, many jurors talked to us outside the courthouse and talked to the media and wrote letters to the newspaper. And they said, because there was an implication, this was jury nullification.
Can you explain what that means to listeners?
Yes, jury nullification is when a jury knows what the law is, believes that the district attorney, the prosecuting attorney, proved beyond a reasonable doubt the elements of the law, but because they believe the law is wrong, chose to vote for acquittal. We don't think this was a case of jury nullification, actually. We think that essentially the elements of the crime were not proven beyond a reasonable doubt. By not pushing for jury nullification, but by utilizing an appropriate defense and utilizing it successfully with wonderful defendants who were absolutely credible and sincere and knowledgeable, we were able to get in the record, the information about international law, and also get acquittal. And the jury expressed to us, any number of members, that the war was not an issue in deliberations, that they could not tell us how their, or they could not tell at all how their fellow jurors actually felt about the war. I suspect the majority of them were against the war.
What points in international law would you cite for our audience?
Well, conceptually, the Nuremberg principles, where international human rights law stresses that we all have a duty to make sure that international human rights law is not violated, and we have a responsibility to ensure that in our communities.
Lynn, let me just pause for a second and tell our audience, if they've just tuned in, that we're speaking with attorney Lynn Williams. She's up in Maine. She's a member of the National Lawyers Guild. She just had a striking victory in defense of six anti-war protesters. And I wanted to switch the subject a little bit, Lynn. I know that you're active in Maine in the Maine Lawyers for Democracy, a group of people who are calling for the impeachment of Bush and Cheney. My own position is we should impeach Cheney first. And I wanted to ask you why you think both of them should be impeached and what you're doing about it.
I'm certainly not as active with Maine Lawyers for Democracy as with the Guild, but I do what I can. While that group is called Maine Lawyers for the Guild, for Democracy, the key activities on the street regarding impeachment are not through the lawyers, but through the activists who are working in this area. I mean, we submitted a petition of over 15,000 signatures to our state legislature. The Speaker of the State Senate refused to accept it into her hands.
How dramatic.
and she's a Democrat, let me say that.
No.
And yes.
I'm shocked.
It was burning, and she recoiled. And the press was there.
Good.
So they saw that. And we continue doing, and I have been involved with this, teach-ins and things of that nature for communities, local communities. Up here, you know, we have town meetings, so it's great to get things passed at local community level. We're getting down to the wire with this impeachment thing, and I always felt it was important to pursue because these gentlemen and their administration need to know there are consequences to things.
For breaking the law.
That was the exactly. That was the first thing. The second thing is to deter our next administration from engaging in the same behavior.
That's a really wise forecast.
You know,
absolutely.
I take the kindergarten approach to things. There are consequences. And look, you who are coming into this class next year, you know what's going to happen to you if you misbehave.
It's really been a treat to have you on.
Oh,
and
thank
we
you.
Wish that you'd travel around the country and do your impeachment organizing elsewhere. Sounds like you've had some great success up there.
What I'd like to do is do my jury selection techniques elsewhere.
Yeah, that was a real coup.
Well, maybe Heidi at the National Lawyers Guild Convention, you can have a workshop on jury selection.
Right on. We'll talk to you soon.
Okay.
When you have your next victory.
Great. Bye-bye.
So
bye.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss. Amnesty International USA brought a life-size Guantanamo cell replica to the National Mall in Washington, D.C. Activists and tourists gathered to experience the bleakness of being held in such confinement, with all hope gone. The cell replica visited the nation's capital as a U.S. House Judiciary Subcommittee heard testimony on harsh interrogation techniques from Vice President Dick Cheney's Chief of Staff, David Addington, and former U.S. Justice Department lawyer, John Yoo. Today we bring you the voices of those visiting the cell replica. Let's have a listen.
Amnesty International's Australian section decided to build this replica cell. They toured it around Australia, and then we thought it would be a good idea to bring it around the United States.
Curious to find out, what type of reaction did it get in Australia?
Pretty much the same here. You've got people who agree with us and believe that Guantanamo should be closed down and the system of illegal detention the U.S. has put in place dismantled. And then there's people who feel very strongly that these people are terrorists and they deserve to be locked up in worse places than this. So we really get, you know, both sides. People are usually amazed at how small it is and how isolating it feels. And then when you throw in, you know, the facts that we give them about how long people have been detained without charge and that they've been denied fundamental legal rights, and many have said that they've been abused and tortured, people really start to feel that this is not the way the United States should be fighting terrorism. Right now we're trying to figure out where we should take it next. We've got some options on the table, and we're just trying to see what we can afford to do. We're hoping to take it to the two conventions and to St. Louis and across the United States to Los Angeles, hopefully.
My family works in the government, and so I had 4 hours to drive, and I saw this and thought it was really interesting. I thought I'd come see how it was. So,
actually, why don't we step inside? We'll step inside the actual cell itself. What are your initial thoughts?
My initial thought is that for a country that, you know, we strive so hard to, you know, fair punishment, fair trials, just a free country, and we really are holding people in a very unjust and undemocratic way, and I think it's really sad, and I think we try to hide it, but I think sometimes it's just unreal. So,
what do you think that experience would be like, just being in here for a couple of minutes?
I think it's incredibly unfortunate, and I think it's made to drive someone crazy. I think that they're not trying to do it that's like the only way to hold them, you know. I think that they're trying to do it because they know it'll drive them crazy, and I think they're trying to be unfair. I think it's a very eye-opening experience. I think the U.S. government tries to hide it and make this kind of a secretive thing, but I think the realities of it are really, really eye-opening and unfair. I'm from Georgia.
I don't know. It's kind of like I think it's like it doesn't really explain the horror that they go through as much. You know, just have like a small room. And I think it's really a lot worse. You know, kind of like I know a lot about torture tactics and stuff like that, and I feel like it just doesn't really kind of adequately show like the type of like mental abuses and things like that. So it's great that you're doing the display.
To be that confined, I can't imagine it being very pleasant, but being held without charges, I don't like the idea of it personally, you know, and this whole thing, this whole terrorist, I mean, I don't want to be blown up, so.
It's an interesting, I think it's a really important issue right now, obviously, in this country, and in the world's eyes, what we're doing with these people, and I would like to be more educated than I am about it right now, and I figured that the people here, I already spoke with Muhammad a little bit, the people here obviously know quite a bit more about this than I do, and I think that, you know, by gaining more knowledge about this, I'll be able to hopefully in the future make some change, if it ever comes to that.
And what was it like to stand in there?
I mean, kind of like I was saying to Muhammad when I was inside there, I can't really put myself in the mindset, I mean, of the people who are in there, who are in the cells on Guantanamo. I've thought about this when I've gone into, you know, mock prison cells, whether or not it has to do with U.S. incarceration or quote-unquote detainee incarceration in Guantanamo. It was nice to go in, I guess, but I know that it was nothing compared to what those guys are feeling down there. I think that although it's important to see this physical replica of what they look like down there, the injustice in my mind, from the limited amount I know about this, is not based on the physical confinement necessarily and the how the cells are, but rather just the condition, the legal reasons why they're down there, and what Muhammad was telling me before, and what I guess we all kind of know about this, their lack of an appeals process or even any type of what I consider a fair trial in our country.
That's
so
more
that's
impressive to you,
yeah. Well, that's more of a pressing issue. I mean, we have guys in our country that are in cells like this, a lot of them, and they not that our criminal justice system is fair by any means, but compared to what's going on down there, I think comparing those two things, I think what's really pressing is the legal problems that we have down in Guantanamo, or lack thereof, I guess. Not necessarily the physical confines. So I did want to see this, and this is one of the main reasons I came out. I'm a fan of Amnesty International. I think they do great work, especially today. It feels like their presence is really important, considering the things our administration has been doing, and I'm sure it always will be. There's always going to be injustices going on around the world. I had a few spare moments and I thought I'd come by, and I'm glad I did. Can't imagine that it would be anything compared to just the involuntary detention in Cuba. I think, you know, whether or not they're in a nice cell or a big cell or a small cell, and obviously this is a small, not nice cell, but a government, in fact, the world power at this point in world history, confining people without legal process. That is what I think would really tear at my heart if I was down there.
All righty. Hey, thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, relate just your experience just being inside the cell. What was it like for you?
It really makes vivid the circumstances of detention that hundreds of people are going through and continue to go through without the means to challenge their confinement. I mean, this is actually a lot more spacious than most of the cells that that most folks at Guantanamo are subjected to. And of course, I go inside, I see what it's like, and I'm free to leave. That is very different than what most people are subjected to in Guantanamo Bay.
What do you think it kind of does to a person to be in that type of confinement, in that situation?
It's dehumanizing. It's a violation of human dignity. And it's a basic human right if one is confined, detained. It's a basic human right to be able to challenge that detention. And people at Guantanamo Bay don't have that right.
Well, I can tell you it's about 6 feet because I lie down on the bed and I'm 6 feet tall and my head hit the side of the wall there, so I can't even lay flat down. I don't know. I would not want to spend 23 hours of my day in here, and especially if I didn't even know I was here, it would just make me depressed and make me want to kill myself. And after I did get out, if I ever did get out, it would make me very angry with whoever put me in here.
Talk about what you think it would impact, I mean, your family as well, if you were in here for years, no charges being brought. How would that impact you and your family as well?
It would probably turn everyone I knew against whoever put me in Guantanamo, obviously the American government, and most immediately that would make my family angry at the American soldiers in Iraq or in Afghanistan or wherever they are in the world. And I think places like this, well, I guess this place in particular, but also situations like Abu Ghraib, are just awful for our image around the entire world. And I think the Bush administration has put a blight on America, and for the next, I don't know, 100, 200 years, it's going to be just awful for the American image. And I think this probably, in the end, will make more terrorists than it does to eliminate them.
Part of the setup in this cell is that you can actually record a video message for YouTube for the president. Did you end up doing that today?
Nope. I didn't want to stay in here that long.
Is there a message that you would send to not only this president, but actually the next president coming up?
The first thing that I would do if I were elected president, and that I would like to see Barack Obama do, is just to apologize to the world for all the things that the Bush administration has done, and to say that that's not how most of America feels, and that was only a very select group of people making those decisions, and we are sorry. That is not how America feels.
One of the things that I saw you lay down on this bed that they have, which is basically cut out of the wall, and there is a, what, maybe inch mattress on it?
About an inch mattress, yes. And I guess what I thought was, it's so short, I wondered if I could actually lay down on it without hitting my head, and I just barely fit. And I'm not 6 feet tall even, so I'm about 5'11", so I thought, that's not much of a bed. My other thoughts were, I've done a lot of reading about what goes on at Gitmo, and to actually step into a facsimile of a Gitmo cage is a little bit more of a way to connect to the people who, you know, as a person, as a compassionate person who cares about human rights, I can connect with the people who are being held there, 50% of whom, according to the Pentagon, are innocent of any crime, unaffiliated with any terrorist group. And to me, this is a great injustice that hurts America and does not make us safer.
So what would you think, just being in here for a couple of minutes, as opposed to the people who are in here 23 hours a day for years, who don't have any charges against them, have no idea when they may be released?
I guess my first thought is it's claustrophobic, and to think that if I were in here for year in, year out, and to think that these walls would be what I'd be looking at for the rest of my life, potentially, since they haven't been offered any hope of due process, I just thought of how miserable that would be.
And is there anything else that you would want to relay about your experience of just being in the Guantanamo cell?
It's hot. It's very hot in here. It's very uncomfortable in here. And I think treating somebody even who's guilty of something in a situation like this is wrong.
So this is, well, someone can come in and make a video for YouTube?
Yeah, you can record a message to the president asking him to shut down Guantanamo, and also your response to having seen a cell and learned about what the center stands for. And it'll go on YouTube, and more people have access to see it, and hopefully the president as well.
So are these cells set up fundamentally for Islamic people?
They're set up for whoever's arrested in the war on terror.
Because I know that in Islam they can't worship, or they can't bow down towards the toilet.
Right.
So, I mean, is it set up fundamentally for that, or is it just kind of
I don't think that was taken into consideration when they built the cells.
So these are just... The people taken into custody are people that we have brought up on suspicion, and they're being held on suspicion only until we can get...
A lot of people were actually turned over actual charges. Because a bounty was placed. Like, people, especially in small towns in Pakistan, were said if you can turn in people who might be involved in Al-Qaeda or involved in our war on terror, we'll give you X amount of dollars. So a lot of people were just... turning people over because they're so poor. So we have a lot of people who really, there's no basis for their detention in the cells.
So the reason we went and got them is because of somebody said this person knows this person who knows this person who is
very
a terrorist.
Few of them were identified by the U.S. government before their detention.
Right. Yeah. So we actually, from Pakistan or Afghanistan or wherever, actually got help from the locals saying, we need your help, point these people out for us.
Yeah.
So they pointed them out and then went and got them. Was there anybody who said, no, these people weren't involved, but yet we still took them anyway?
I think that most of the people, I mean, there wasn't kind of like, is this person really Al-Qaeda? It was someone's name was handed over and that person was collected without looking for any sort of real evidence other than someone in the town named one.
I was the Muslim chaplain assigned to Guantanamo Bay in late November 2002 through September of 2003, and this was a time when much of the abuse of prisoners in Guantanamo occurred. I was there for 10 months. I raised concerns about many of the abuses, about the horrible conditions of Guantanamo, the ages of some of the prisoners who were as young as 12 years old. And in return for challenging Bush policies of Guantanamo, I was then targeted myself, accused of being a spy, of engaging in espionage and aiding the suspected Taliban and Al-Qaeda prisoners in Guantanamo, and thrown in prison. I was locked away for 76 days in isolation at the Consolidated Naval Break in Charleston, South Carolina, alongside noted U.S. citizen enemy combatants. The names we're familiar with, Jose Padilla, Yasser Hamdi, and others. I was there for 76 days until I was suddenly released. The military attempted to court-martial me, put me on trial for what they eventually charged me with, mishandling classified information, But in the end, even those charges would be dropped. My record would be wiped clean. I was reinstated as a Muslim chaplain, after which I would resign my commission, receive an honorable discharge, in addition to a second U.S. Army Commendation Medal for exceptional meritorious service. And today I've cut all ties to the military. I've documented my experience being in the military, being a third-generation Chinese-American born here in the United States, a graduate of West Point, who became a Muslim chaplain and then was wrongfully accused. The title of my book is called For God and Country, Faith and Patriotism Under Fire. And today I travel across the country lecturing about Guantanamo, human rights, and civil liberties issues, which are relevant to everyone in this country. This is a replica of a cell in what's known as Camp 5 or Camp 6 in Guantanamo. Those facilities did not exist when I was in Guantanamo. When I was there, prisoners were held in open-air cell-like cages in what's known as Camp Delta. These facilities came much later, in which millions of dollars was poured into Guantanamo to build these much more permanent facilities in which the cells keep the prisoner in a much more isolated environment. But I am very familiar with what it's like to live in this cell because I myself was jailed in a cell similar to this in Charleston, South Carolina at the Consolidated Naval Brig. The only difference really between this cell and the one that I was in is that the toilet and sink facility was made of porcelain instead of the steel that you have here. And in the cell I was kept, there were two cameras keeping me under surveillance 24 hours a day. Of course, there are no surveillance cameras in this cell. No one can really imagine what it's like to be held indefinitely for going on 7 years now. Guantanamo Bay, Cuba has been in existence now for over 6 years, well into its seventh year, in which prisoners are essentially locked away in this legal black hole. Not one of us can imagine what it's like to be held indefinitely without due process, without legal rights, without being able to see our attorneys when we need to, and being accused without being able to contest one's innocence because your habeas rights have been stripped away. All of this takes, in my view, a tremendous psychological and mental toll on a human being. And it's clear just from the amount of time I spent in Guantanamo, even in the very early stages of this infamous prison camp, the psychological abuse and the mental torment that these individuals have experienced.
Those were the voices of tourists, activists, and James Yee, former U.S. Army chaplain, who ministered to Muslim detainees held at Guantanamo Bay Naval Base. Yee is known for being subject to an intense investigation by the United States. We thank Free Speech Radio news correspondent Karen Miller for gathering the audio for this segment.
If you have any comments or questions about this segment or any others, please visit us at lawanddisorder.org.